Welcome to this special edition of St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We, the rest of the nation, and much of the world have sights set on Washington University, the site of tonight's second presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. In view of recent events, it may now be the most important presidential debate in recent history, perhaps ever. To say anticipation is high is probably an understatement. We've got it all covered as debate time approaches. Reporters Joe Manis, Jason Rosenbaum, and Dale Singer are on campus to set the stage. With me in studio are Dr. Diana Carlin, St. Louis University Emerita Professor of Communication and a nationally recognized expert on political debates. Dr. David Robertson chairs the Political Science Department at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Thank you both so much for being with us. Let me start it this way. Are either of you surprised that there even is a debate tonight, Dr. Carl?
No, I'm not surprised. We've found out over the years that it's very difficult for a candidate to avoid a debate. They are usually criticized. George H.W. Bush tried to get out of three debates and kept postponing and ended up with three. George W. Bush tried to do some things on with talk shows as opposed to debates, and there's usually a public reaction to that. And I think especially in light of what's been happening, it's going to be important to show up for the debate tonight.
Dave?
The only question I have is whether Trump believes that he should play by those rules and if he cares about the reaction, because he seems to think that his supporters will be probably positively disposed to see him not go on the stage, at least in his own mind. So I think it still could. He still could withdraw because some of those conventions that weigh down on other candidates don't seem to weigh down on him at all. But I think he has some points he would like to make and probably will show up.
Boy, the idea of him pulling out at this juncture is almost unthinkable.
Well, and I think especially since it's the town hall.
Yeah.
You have citizens who have shown up, and to stand up a group of undecided voters, I don't think would be in his best interest at this
point. Well, that's right, yeah.
Diana, does the town hall format favor one candidate over another in this circumstance?
Well, Hillary Clinton has more experience with it than Donald Trump does. I heard that he did a practice run, I think, in New Hampshire the other day. She will probably be a little more at ease because she's been out there among the public for so many more years. But Trump is more a populist-type candidate, and I think he'll be comfortable with talking to the average person. So she might have a slight advantage, but I think he'll find a comfort level with it.
Do you have any feelings on that, Dave?
I think he will be comfortable with questions that feed into the message he wants to give. I'm not sure how comfortable he's going to be with questions that really challenge him. And they might be much more pointed than the questions that come from the moderators. That's the kind of response I'm waiting to see.
Diana, you were saying before we went on the air that the first question, which I assume, and I think many people assume, is going to deal with the revelations of the past couple of days, as to who that question comes from.
Well, I don't know if it'll be the first, but I'm speculating that that question will come from one of the audience members as opposed to from one of the two moderators. You know, the moderators are going to be asking half the questions, and they're going to be basing them on what they've been finding on social media, of what people are interested in. But it seems like that's one that should come from a citizen. And it will be interesting to see if they pick a woman to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That will create a very interesting dynamic if they do.
Feel the same way.
I agree completely.
A fact we should point out is the fact that the people asking the questions tonight, the just plain folks like us, are undecided voters. Mm-hmm. I wonder how that plays into the mix. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, they're chosen by the Gallup organization as undecided voters, and they will be trying to ask questions that a lot of people, I think, in the viewing audience are going to be wondering about. One of the things about a town hall is that people who are watching can identify with some of those questioners. So the individual asking a question is not just asking for herself or himself. They're asking for a whole lot of other people.
Yeah,
that's exactly what my research has shown over the years. Since 1992, and I started at Washington University during that debate, I've been doing focus groups. And I've had friends who do them across the country. And the town hall response from our focus groups has been universally that they view these citizens as their surrogates. Yeah. And that they do ask the kinds of questions they want asked, and usually on topics that are very different from what the media necessarily wants to hear about. And if you heard the undecided voters after the first debate, some of them were complaining, well, I wanted to hear about this and I wanted to hear about that. Mm-hmm. And that's not what the media was asking about, nor what the candidates themselves were inserting into the debate. So I do think you'll see some different directions tonight.
None of us has a crystal ball, but let me ask this. Is this the election? Is this debate tonight the election in terms of determinative?
No. And the reason I say that is because of all the events of recent days, I don't think anything Trump can do can change the path of this election. He's completely in the power of events and of the Clinton campaign. If the Clinton campaign falters, if she says something terrible or a new revelation comes out, it will make a difference. If some event happens, a terrorist attack, that'll make a difference. But I think Trump is out of control of this.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think any single debate makes or breaks an election. Mm-hmm. And the last debate will be the 19th, and you still have, what, 2.5 weeks
yes.
before Election Day.
Mm-hmm.
That's several lifetimes. I mean, look at what's happened just in the last few days that no one would have predicted. Mm-hmm. And this is the most unpredictable of unpredictable election situations.
One of the reasons it's unpredictable, and I've heard people talk about this and watching the events unfold over the weekend, is given Mr. Trump's unpredictability, is he has in a sense, nothing to lose. He can say or really do
right.
anything he wants. You agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his base is solid. There are still people who are soft supporters, and there are still some undecideds out there, mm-hmm. and people who are still considering a third-party candidate, and you know that may be weakening also given mm-hmm. some events recently with Gary Johnson. So, you know, he may be able to pick up a few people here or there,
mm-hmm.
but those individuals who are a solid base, I agree that they're not going anywhere.
No.
It's those Republicans who, you know, are doing this because they're being loyal to the party and it's the best thing. And will they actually check that box or not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Dave Robertson, Hillary Clinton is bringing some baggage into this debate as well, given
Absolutely.
The revelations about the emails and her conversations, her speech at Goldman Sachs. Emails hacked from her campaign manager, mm-hmm. John Podesta. She's going to get some questions tonight, too, that'll be tough.
Absolutely. And I think, to some extent, Trump's comments eclipsed in the video of Trump, eclipsed that story about the hacked emails. But we're going to hear about that tonight, and there are some embarrassing moments for her. Now, I think a lot of people expected worse than we've seen, but they're bad enough to force her to do some explaining.
Right.
I think the statement that caught my eye more than anything else was that you have to have a public and a private
yes.
position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was obviously in a speech she did not expect to ever be made public.
Yes.
And, you know, for individuals who question her veracity, trustworthiness, mm-hmm. that kind of statement can be very harmful. It'll be interesting to see if either Anderson Cooper or Martha Raddatz picks up on that particular comment.
Right, and the additional baggage to that claim is this is just another politician, which is very unpopular this year.
Diana, this may be unfair. Forgive me if it is, but if you were advising these candidates tonight, how would you advise them to approach this debate? What would your advice be?
Well, I think one thing they have to keep in mind is that these are citizens. They are not professional interviewers. And so those questions may not always be worded as clearly as possible. And so to ask if you aren't sure. You know, mm-hmm. George H.W. Bush got into trouble with the woman who asked the kind of clunky question about the deficit affecting him, and that mm-hmm. hurt him. So I think they need to realize that they better verify, because if the person and everybody watching thinks they've been avoiding answering it just because it wasn't worded carefully, it still is going to hurt them. I think one thing that's very difficult with the town hall is simply the staging of it. There is no podium. And, you know, we've seen people invading other people's spaces. I think one thing Donald Trump cannot do tonight is he cannot invade Hillary Clinton's space.
Yeah.
And
been there, tried that in the past debates.
Right.
It didn't work.
Yeah. But I think they just have to be very sensitive to the fact that this is a different set of questions, a different set of questioners, a very different dynamic overall. And it's also very awkward to just be standing up there. They'll probably have a stool to sit on in between. But as a woman, that's kind of a difficult thing to do. Mm-hmm. So the space issues, just the very different kind of environment, I think, is a challenge.
Right. Yeah. I think the questioners are going to have to feel that the candidates understood their question and were empathetic in answering what it is they're so worried about, you know, getting to the worry more than the underlying question. And if they take off and attack the other person before they answer that question, I think that's going to be seen as a real disconnect. The other thing about this is we're going to see the audience reaction. That could be a real problem for the candidates if they turn people off.
I wonder if we're going to see their individual reactions. The split screen was used in the last debate and really had quite a bearing, I think, on the way people perceived what was going on. I'm not sure they can do that effectively if they're moving around.
Yeah, it'll be a little more difficult. But, you know, I agree also that this empathy piece is important. And the one thing I heard from students I was teaching last week and then other people who've been talking with me, and you've heard it once again in some of the other focus groups that were done on air, is that there was really no direct connection with this voter anger in that first debate.
Mm-hmm.
No one was providing that kind of empathy, and you're absolutely right. If they don't do it in this debate, then I think they both have a problem.
Yeah. We have an email here. Edward writes, and it's a good question. When were the citizen participants chosen as undecided? And obviously that has happened in the recent past. Haven't the events of the past 3 days certainly caused many undecideds to move to Mrs. Clinton's direction? What effect might this have? Good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. You know, there's no way to ever pick people at a stage where you know there isn't going to be an event that changes their minds. Back in 96, I was given access to the group of questioners after the debate. And I gave them the surveys that I was doing in my national research and asked, you know, are you undecided going in, whatever. A lot of them indicated, even though Gallup had selected them as undecided, that they were leaning but hadn't confirmed. So how people define undecided is very different than maybe what Gallup was asking.
Right. The undecided vote this year has been pretty high, and it's settling in, but it's still higher than it has been in the past. So I think there genuinely are people often conflicted about what they think are the lesser of two evils. Yeah. And there's plenty of ammunition against both of these candidates, and they're still trying to work their way through that.
But after 14 months or whatever it's been, it's really hard to imagine that minds aren't made up by now.
Some of us are procrastinators.
Some of us are indeed. We're waiting to talk to Joe Manis on campus, but before we do that, hosting a debate, as you well know, is not inexpensive. A few days ago, we spoke with the chair of the steering committee for tonight's debate, Steve Givens. He is associate vice chancellor at WashU, was co-chair of the debates in 2000, 2004, and co-chair of the vice presidential debate in 2008. I asked him about the cost.
This has certainly changed over the years.
Sure.
My first debate in 2000, I think the fee that we paid up front to the commission was $450,000. And then, of course, we incur a lot of other expenses just to get the university ready. This time, that upfront fee is just shy of $2 million.
Whoa.
So it's $1.9 million. And we figure we'll probably spend another couple million, so probably $4 to $5 million will be our full ticket price of the money we have to pay, and then everything we have to do to get the facility ready and to provide the kind of hospitality for the media. And you know, we want to do it right, and we need to meet all the technical requirements that it's spelled out in the contract between us and the commission. So, yeah, we know going in it's not cheap, but you need to do it right.
I'm bowled over by that number. That is a lot of money. Where does it come from?
It comes from our operating budget. So In the past, we have had some years when we've had some local sponsors who have helped pay for that. This year, we just opted not to do that, and we're taking it all from our operating budget.
That's Steve Givens of Washington University. He is the chair of the steering committee for tonight's debate. Dave Robertson, the question, I guess, is do students get their money's worth at $5 million?
Well, they get prestige, and it adds to WashU's prestige internationally. So I don't know if it's worth that much money, but it's kind of like buying a personal seat license for a football team. Gosh, I find that amount of money pretty high. And, you know, whether or not it pays off in the long run, hard to say. It has to do with the branding.
Well, it may be. What do you think, Diane? This may be the most watched debate in history tonight.
This one may be. I think, you know, the reason it's gotten so much more expensive is security. Mm-hmm. If you stop and think about the first year that Washington University hosted it, this is all pre-9/11. Mm-hmm. You have some security. And it was certainly out there because I was around the campus at that time. But nothing like what we've had post-9/11, plus given just the environment this year and with these two mm-hmm. candidates. And then just the whole media needs are much greater. You know, the Wi-Fi, we didn't have that in 92, right. And they have to have their own Wi-Fi system. So there are just a lot of technical aspects of it. But as far as whether it's of value to the students, what goes on a campus for the whole week before these debates is phenomenal. And they bring in speakers, and you have activities, and I've been at several of them and have had the opportunity to lecture. And it really generates enthusiasm. Plus, they're hearing from people they wouldn't hear from otherwise. Yeah. So I think in the long run, what it does for the current students is really important. Plus, I agree with Dave that it helps the brand.
But the question is, and it's an important one, are these students and those a little older, the millennials, going to be voting in this election? What do you think, Dave? What's your feedback from your students?
Well, I think students are very interested in what's going on. Whether or not they turn out to vote for the two major candidates as opposed to the third-party candidates is going to be interesting to me. There are a lot of students who are turned off by Hillary Clinton as a typical politician, but there are a whole lot of students who are absolutely appalled by Donald Trump. And so I think the students are going to lean toward Clinton over Trump to the extent that they vote. I'm not sure African-American students are as excited about this election as, say, white students would be. And that could be an issue for the vote in some places, particularly in some of the southern states.
A lot of them still feeling the burn, too, and may just be deciding to sit it out. Right.
Yes. And I think that's one thing we talked about earlier was the email revelations this week, that some of those Bernie Sanders supporters who were starting to go toward Clinton may rethink that.
Yeah. Right.
So they're a volatile group right now. Yeah. I think there's high interest. If you look once again, there were 450 students who were in the Center for Global Citizenship over here at St. Louis University the night of the first debate. I was in Lawrence, Kansas. There were 150 at the Dole Institute of Politics that night, the biggest crowd they've ever had of students. And I was speaking to a large group of even international students who were following it.
Yeah.
And I know other friends of mine around the country who've been doing it. So there's a high interest level. Now, whether it generates into actually showing up and how they will vote, very hard to predict.
Yeah, thanks to Anita Mannion and our Political Science Academy, we had 120 for the first debate at a commuter school. So that was really impressive.
Well, if there were ever an election to get involved, I think most people would agree this is the one. While we're talking about students, our intern, Natalie Martinez, spent some time on campus this week and talked with students about their debate expectations. We should note that she talked to the students during the week before the release of those inflammatory Trump comments about women. Here they are.
I think it's definitely a big deal for a lot of students. This is a really great way to know that our campus is engaged in politics, but I don't think that's necessarily how everyone feels. I know that I am pretty uncomfortable with Trump even being on campus, particularly. Not that I'm, like, crazy about either candidate.
I think that WashU is strangely more representative of the general population of America than people might like to think it is. Voices that otherwise have remained silent, thinking that they don't have any backers on campus, and I'm referring mostly to conservative voices, will speak out more, and I think that's good.
It's also a great way for WashU students to really speak up about some of the topics that we would like the candidates to talk about that weren't really brought up during the first debate. Things that are impacting the whole nation as a whole, but also St. Louis particularly.
It will get people talking about national issues and WashU's place in those national issues. I know one that both candidates have spoke to is student debt. And WashU specifically, students, a third of students graduate with debt. I hope that the debate helps WashU talk about some of the issues the rest of the world is facing and realize that we have a role in those conversations.
Very rarely does anyone have the chance to be right there, right at the source of what many books in general will be talking about for the next few centuries with regard to American politics.
Because we are hosting the debate especially, I think that there's been a reluctance to condemn some of the just objectively terrible things that have been said in the course of this election. There's also a fear that because this election is so polarizing that particularly Trump supporters will be emboldened to come on campus or even directly off campus and sort of enact the violence that he's been encouraging. And so that's a scary thing to be on our campus.
Students at Washington University, M. Alvis, Dan Sikorsky, Pablo Zavala, Nina Stoller, Nicholas Kinberg, and Elaine Emmerich, students. That was recorded just a couple of days ago. Have attitudes changed since that recording? Education reporter Dale Singer is on campus getting a sense of student atmosphere as the event approaches. Dale, are you with us?
I'm here.
What are you hearing?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've reported first to the what they call the public expression zone, which is on what is normally an intramural field between the main campus and the dormitories. They told us it was going to open up at 3, but it turns out it's not actually going to open up till 3:30. But even here now, as 3:30 approaches, there's really only a smattering of outsiders who are here. So it's hard to gauge you know, what the outside sentiment is. There are people here who are pro-Trump. There are people here who are pro-Clinton. There are people here who are representing different groups. The most popular people, as far as the photographers, the amateur and the professional ones who are around here, are a pair who are dressed up as the devil and the Grim Reaper, saying, you know, when the devil says, Trump sold me his soul, what a ripoff, there was nothing there. So that's kind of the humor. I mean, I was at the quad on the way over here, and it was a fairly festive atmosphere, you know. I guess what you'd often see on a beautiful Sunday afternoon on a college campus, Frisbee games going on. But there were also a lot of media tents and media trucks and students who were lining up to take part in there were games and things like that. So it's a fairly festive atmosphere at this point. Of course, the debate doesn't start for another 4-plus hours, so it's hard to tell what things are going to be like then.
Well, you're right. It certainly is a beautiful day to be outside. Have you had a chance to talk to any of these folks and get some sense of maybe how they're reacting to what's been going on the last couple of days?
I talked to one woman who was a Trump supporter, and she said no. She thinks it's a bunch of the whole word she uses is hogwash. It happened 11 years ago. She doesn't think it's really relevant to this. She thinks Trump's general policies are what she would like to see the country follow. And I asked her if she had a daughter, would she want her to be in Trump's company? And she said, I have a daughter. I have a granddaughter. I'd be proud for them to be hanging out with him. So it's not necessarily a representative crowd since it's so small, but you're certainly getting all points of view here.
Well, you mentioned that there are a few folks there in costume. Is there any sign of any kind of protesting, as sometimes that happens at events like this, or is everything quite orderly?
It's very orderly. It's there's nothing what you would call hard edge. I certainly wouldn't expect two groups to start shouting at each other. It's very low-key and mellow here. Like I say, it's a beautiful afternoon, and, you know, people have signs, but I don't see that people from one side are mixing with the other. There's kind of in conversation. Now, once the actual field is open, and that should be any minute now, and people, you know, take positions and start trying to convince whoever is in the crowd that their point of view is the right one, maybe things will get a little bit more contentious. But right now, it's very orderly, very friendly.
This is kind of a Hyde Park situation, I guess, where people can express any opinions they have, and I don't want to call it a safe space, but a prescribed space.
Right. Yeah, it's called the public expression. So it's really kind of eerie because, of course, they've got Big Ben closed off, so people are taking advantage of it and to run and walk their dogs and bike up and down here. Mm-hmm. And you know, obviously on a Sunday afternoon, or certainly on a regular afternoon, the Big Ben would be crowded with traffic, but the whole atmosphere here is really pretty laid back. And like I say, I don't know whether or not that's going to stay that way once the actual site is open, but for now, that's the way it is.
Okay, well, enjoy your time outside, and thank you very much for being with us, Dale Singer. Hope things go smoothly for you and for everybody over there today.
My pleasure. If I hear anything different, I will let you know.
Thank you so much, sir. Dale Singer, sure. Reporting from Washington University. I think we finally found Jo Manis. She had an apparent problem getting through security, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. But she is a veteran of debate coverage at Washington University, and she's over there today paying special attention to what politicians and pundits are saying or doing, those that are here. Jo, you with us?
Yeah. Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you just fine. You had a little trouble with security? Is that a problem over there?
Well, I could tell you if you're a reporter and not here yet. I mean, they separate you from your equipment and from your purse and everything, and then everybody goes through everything. But there was a Big Ben full of tossed out soda, so I thought I was going to be as bad because I'm a Diet Coke junkie. But the TSA guy, the one guy said she's got to toss it out, and the other guy said no, she doesn't. So I'm fine. So my throat will be good for this evening.
Good. Good.
But yeah, I mean it's security stiff as it should be. You know, I'm making light of it. But I saw Andrew Mitchell and a couple other of the big shots, TV big shots, who were going through security.
Well,
I guess you haven't seen
Mr. Trump. I've just been advised that he has arrived at the debate hall. So you're not there, but he is.
Well, you know, that might explain something. I was at an event, a Real Clear Politics event before this in Clayton. So I was driving down Forest Park Boulevard to get down here. And right before the university, they blocked everything off temporarily. I was freaking out for a second. So a bunch of cars and a ambulance and other stuff were zooming down. Zooming down going west, which would be Forest Park to 170. So I was thinking right then that one of them had arrived. You know, I mean, this is maybe an hour ago.
That's about right.
So that might be about right. They, you know, because there's always an ambulance with a motorcade when it's one of the nominees. So that could very well have been, it's either him or Hillary. And then they, you know, got him and then bring it. So they have a pretty quick trip here from the airport here.
You've covered a number of these debates at Washington University. Is the atmosphere, as you've observed it so far, really any different today than it might have been at past events?
Security seems a little tighter. But most of the staff here, because they dealt with this before, most of the staff is, I mean, I have to say, they've done it 5 times. They were picked 6 times. They know how to do it. So everything here is pretty smooth. A lot of the students have been wandering around. There's a couple things in the outside of the secure area on campus that they can go to. So, yeah, there seems to be it's sort of a party atmosphere a little bit, but subdued. I mean, I noticed that everybody seems to see this as serious business. You did see that.
Have you had a chance really to talk to anybody that you would normally run across on your beat, to wit politicians, or those would be an early start for them to be there already. But who have you talked to and what are folks saying?
Well, as I said, I was at this Real Clear Politics panel. They had a two-hour thing at one of the hotels in Clayton, and a lot of the big shots were there. Lacey Clay was there, and they were all interviewed. They were on stage, and Clay was pretty interesting. He was talking about how he's fairly confident Clinton is going to win. But what was interesting to me was that he had really nice words for Roy Blunt, who's a Republican running for re-election, emphasizing that he's always worked well with Blunt. So while he didn't knock Democratic candor at all, because he's a Democrat, but I thought it was interesting that he kind of worked that into his conversation. And there was a great panel between the two Missouri party chairmen, Republican John Hancock and Democrat Roy Temple. Hancock was extremely candid. He predicts that Trump will easily win the state, but he acknowledges that he said even the best of times that Trump passed the victory, any Republican passed the victory in the White House is difficult, because he says that the Democrats automatically have 242 almost guaranteed electoral votes. So they only have to come up with 28, which is just a couple other states, two or three other states, where he said that Republicans have to, quote, run the table, unquote. And he said that's without all this stuff that's swirling around Trump. Hancock also said that he was telling Republicans who feel that they need to back away from him to do what they have to do, if whatever's best for their campaign.
Which Senator Blunt has not done, and which Ann Wagner has done. Any discussion about that? Was Ann Wagner at this event earlier?
No, she wasn't, but her name came up a lot. She was on the panel that I was on. We were talking about it. And I'll say this. For Roy Blunt, she's going to rely on a strong turnout in rural Missouri. He cannot, he probably cannot, distance himself from Donald Trump. Congresswoman...
Wagner?
Not Wagner, but Vicki Hensler was on a panel. And one of the things that she was emphasizing, because she's from rural Missouri, she says, I don't like what he said, but I like his policy. So that's sort of the mantra for Republicans who are from that part of the state or who need that part of the vote. So Blunt really can't. Now, Ann Wagner, on the other hand, represents suburban St. Louis. Trump probably is not very popular in suburban St. Louis. She was never a fan of Trump to begin with. She reluctantly endorsed him this summer. So it was no sweat for her yesterday to say, I'm not with him anymore. And it probably doesn't cost her anything. Actually, it probably helped her with her suburban voters. So there's two big differences about why Blunt's doing what he's doing and why she's doing what she's doing.
One other question for you, Joe, before I turn back to our guests here in studio. Anybody expressing any, Hancock says that he thinks Trump is going to win, but anybody expressing concerns about the down ballot situation and the fact that could be impacted by this election?
Well, as I said, Hancock has said before, and he reaffirmed that today, if he thinks that Trump wins the state in high singles or double digits, let's say 10 or more, he thinks there could be a down ballot effect. But Roy Temple, who's the Democratic Party chairman, made clear that he doesn't think that's going to happen. I mean, Roy did not say that Hillary was going to win the state. He sort of implied she's not. But he thinks it's going to be a lot closer, and so he thinks that will help Democrats down ballot. And, of course, he's really bullish on Candor's chances in the contest against Blunt, as well as Missouri Attorney General Chris Cotter, who's the Democrat running for governor.
Okay. Well, Joe Manis, thank you so much for spending a little time with us on a pretty day at Washington University's lovely campus. Great to have you. And we'll be talking to you again tomorrow after all of this transpires on St. Louis on the Air at noon. Joe, thank you for being with us.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Okay. What do you think? Hear anything there? Dave Robertson, I'll start with you. Anything there that caught your ear, but particularly interested in the down ballot situation?
Right. I think the first thing that strikes me is that Roy Blunt is in a position that lots of Republicans are in nationwide. Those who are running statewide in places where there are lots of strong suburban areas, but also a lot of strong rural areas. The division in the Republican Party is something Paul Ryan has to walk across like a tightrope, and I think Roy Blunt does too. I think there are lots and lots of very enthusiastic Tea Party people who support Trump, but lots of establishment Republicans who are on the fence or even repelled, in the case of many college education women, just repelled by Trump. And losing those areas like Webster Groves and Kirkwood by a notable margin is going to be a serious problem for Roy Blunt statewide. It'll be a problem for the other Republicans too.
Diana, let me go back into history just slightly with you. I mean, everybody's making a big deal out of this debate because of what's been happening the last couple of days. Historically, how important have debates been in terms of electing people?
There's really no clear evidence that any of the debates has made or broken a candidacy. No. I think the Kennedy-Nixon debate is probably one of the ones where people point to as more likely having had an impact because it was such a small margin with the popular vote and enough percentage changed as a result of the debate or whatever, you know, firmed up. But even that one is totally questionable. And one thing I'd like to say about that one is there's this myth out there that people who listened on the radio thought Nixon had won and people who watched on TV, and it's repeated. I've seen it in the Washington Post a couple weeks ago. That was one survey out of dozens with a very small number of subjects. It was like 150, and the majority of them were Republican. But that has taken on this mythology. Typically what debates do is they reinforce what people are already planning on doing. They're trying to reduce whatever dissonance, discomfort they might have with the candidate. They look, it's basically a bias confirmation kind of effect, where this is where they were leaning, they see what they want to see. For undecided voters, it's very important. And this is, as Dave was saying, it's an unusual year in that we have a higher percentage than we typically have. But in the past, it hasn't made a huge difference. Maybe one place it might have mattered to was Gerald Ford when he liberated Poland a little early. And it wasn't so much that he did that, but it was the way he handled it afterwards. So it's not often just the debate itself, but kind of everything surrounding and how they deal with the problem.
Yeah, and looking back, we'll say the same thing about Trump and the comments that he made after the first debate.
Mm-hmm. You know, Diana, you brought up something that I wanted to bring up with regard to listening to the debate versus watching it with Nixon and Kennedy, obviously the most famous story. A lot of people will be listening tonight, hopefully on NPR and this radio station, and obviously a lot of people will be watching. For those listening, what should they listen for? You can't tell if somebody hasn't shaved or whether they're sweating above their upper lip. Is there a way to do that?
Well, I think in some ways when you have to listen, you're really concentrating much more than when you have the television on, because when you have both the verbal and the nonverbal going on, and especially with the split screen, you often miss some things. So I think the people who listen on the radio may actually tune in a little more closely. But I think whether you're watching or you're listening, what people really need to pay attention to are looking for the answers to whatever unanswered questions they still have about these two candidates. If they're looking to seek confirmation, then, you know, is there something out there that helps them firm up that decision, feel comfortable, defend it to other family members or friends, because people do talk at the water cooler or whatever, or email or Facebook and everything else we have with social media now. If they are undecided, then, you know, what is it that's important to you, and who's better suggesting that they meet your values and your needs?
Speaking of social media, by the way, our reporters out in the field that we've been speaking to today are posting updates on what they're seeing and hearing on Twitter. So you can find out more about that at stlpublicradio.org. How about you, Dave? Do you have a take with regard to watching, listening, that dynamic?
I completely agree that people are going to be concentrating a little bit more when they listen to the radio. I think they'll miss some of the body language, and that could be important as a cue, especially in this debate So, and also the visuals of the reaction of the individual questioner in the audience.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, I understand our Jason Rosenbaum, who's also on campus and will be one of those tweeting during the course of the day and the time that he's here, is available to us now. He's in the Media Center on campus, which I'm told is starting to fill up with journalists. There are only going to be about 3,000 of them there, Jason. Is there enough room for them?
Just barely. Right now, it's, I would say, a third full. There's not a huge amount going on right now. I think people are just probably speculating how the debate will go ad nauseum. And obviously talking about the events of the last 48 hours, which have been harrowing, but for people who have followed Missouri politics, not terribly unfamiliar. So, but, you know, security was pretty good. There are students kind of milling around the quad next to the big media outlets like Fox News and MSNBC. And I think people are just settling in and getting ready.
What is the setup? We're looking at a lot of cubicles or just benches of desks, if you will, or benches as desks, if you will. Give us a picture of what it's like.
Well, some of the bigger media outlets have actually rented booths, and I would guess that's like Sirius XM or CNN or NBC or whatnot. The rest of the media basically is situated in this almost endless row of tables. And the table has a place for you to plug in your computer. There's a chair. And for us, there's a malt box, even though, you know, there's three of us here. I think only one of us would really need to use the malt box to record the actual debate. So really, actually, for a place that is going to house literally hundreds, if not thousands of people, actually kind of comfortable, which isn't always the case at these big gatherings. I was at the Democratic National Convention, and if you weren't a certain media member, it could be quite uncomfortable covering the goings-on of that situation.
Will the reporters there actually get to see the debate firsthand, or will they be watching it on a big screen or something?
Well, there's actually a bunch of little screens that are in front of all the tables. And that's pretty much what everybody is going to be watching. I can't imagine there are that many people from the media who will be in the actual debate room. Although I'm sure there's Joe Manis, my colleague, is shaking her head no. And so basically, the journalists are in this media filing center. This is also where the spinners are going to come and try to convince us that Clinton is the greatest debater since Lincoln, or Trump is the greatest debater since, you know, Trump. And, you know, that's going to be the appeal for someone like us, where we can see some of these national political types and hopefully get a local spin on this entire shindig.
Stay with us for just a second, Jason. Diana, you were shaking your head there. What did you want to add to that?
Oh, the fact that the journalists are in a separate room is, first of all, there are too many of them to get into most of the halls, and you want to let students and other people in. But the idea is they should see it the way that everybody else is seeing it. And there's a big difference between watching it live and watching the television. I know in 88, when I went to the first debate between Bush and Dukakis, I found George H.W. Bush incredibly engaging, coming across really well, relating to the audience. And then I went home and watched it on TV the next day. And he was too big for the screen, you know, too active. And Dukakis knew how to talk to the camera. So I had a very different impression. So I think it's important that the journalists see it the way that everybody else is.
I'm wondering about the international contingent of journalists, because I sense an enormous interest worldwide in this debate. I mean, probably more than in the past. And so I'm wondering how many international journalists from many different sources are here in St. Louis to report on this.
Jason, do you have any sense of that? Have you been able to determine that this early?
I don't have the exact numbers, but I would imagine that pretty much every major international media outlet in the world is probably sending somebody here. I know that Joe Manis, my colleague, has been interviewed by an Australian news outlet, and I'm sure the BBC is around, and I'm sure that there are other media outlets from around the world that is covering this. Again, it's similar to some of the national conventions. The amount of media that was at the national convention in Philadelphia was enormous, and I'm sure that it was even larger in Cleveland. And this is just the type of thing that generates just widespread interest among news outlets, because I think that there's a genuine interest in the public about what's going on here. But most of the people who are going to be watching this are going to be watching it on television and watching the actual debate. Few people actually get to see the behind the scenes and get to see the spinning take place right before their eyes. So it's an interesting and amazing privilege at the same time.
Well, the important question now, Jason, any celebrity sightings?
Well, I did,
media celebrity, that is.
I did see Andrea Mitchell when I was walking through security.
She must be everywhere. Joe's seen her too.
Yeah, Joe and I walked through security around the same time. And, you know, there was a cutout cardboard head of Wolf Blitzer that I saw, but that wasn't actually Wolf Blitzer. It was more of a homage to Wolf Blitzer, who happened to be a very famous member of my fraternity, Alpha Epsilon Pi. So when I saw that, I was very touched to see the tribute to my fraternity brother.
There's the fraternity plug. We couldn't get couldn't get through without that. One final question, and then I'll come back to our guests in studio here. You have written about, and we have talked about on this program, the need to, the prospect of either of the candidates going to Ferguson at some point during their stay here in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Any rumblings about that that you've heard?
None whatsoever. And I think with the turmoil that's been within the Trump campaign, it's very, very unlikely that he'll be going to Ferguson. And I talked to a few people who either represent or live in Ferguson, and many of them are just absolutely incensed about how Donald Trump said that their city was one of the most dangerous places in the world, which is not. That's just flat out false. Let me just not even sugarcoat it. I think that there also is some disappointment that Hillary Clinton hasn't gone there either. She was in Floreson about a year ago, and there have been some who have argued that Floreson is close enough to Ferguson, but for the people that live in Ferguson, it's not the same. They're two very different cities, and just because you're close by and just thematically that it's similar, I think that they kind of don't really understand why she didn't go there and talk to residents and try to see where, you know, what many people see as the new civil rights movement basically started. So I think at this point in the campaign, it's kind of too little, too late for either candidates. It would probably be a very short visit. And given what's happened with Trump, it's just not likely that he's going to go. And I haven't heard that Hillary Clinton is going to go either.
All right. Jason, thank you so much. Perhaps it'll come up during the debate tonight, the subject of Ferguson, Black Lives Matter, and some things that haven't been talked about all that much heretofore. Thank you so much, Jason. Have a good day out there.
You too. Bye.
All right. Dave, you look like you're chomping at the bit to say something about that.
When Donald Trump sent out that tweet, I tweeted that I would be happy to have a beer with him in Ferguson, and because it's right near my office, but I never heard back, so that's okay.
Diana Carlin, what do you think? Would that have been a smart move, do you think, for either or both of them to spend a little time there?
Oh, I think for both of them to have done it. You know, this was the center of the storm for, you know, a year, and you still hear about it any time any of these other shootings have happened. So I think, once again, it gets back to this notion of the empathy and the underpinnings for all the anger. And so to have made a visit would have probably made a pretty positive statement for both of them.
It does seem to me, Dave, and I'll go to you on this, that there hasn't been a whole lot of talk in the campaign that I've heard about these things.
Oh, well, there's a lot about violence and violence
but
in cities.
But law and order, and then that's it. There's really no specifics.
Right. Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
Going back to Jason's position there with in the media center, this may be a silly question, maybe an obvious answer. But what about media coverage of these things, Diana? I mean, obviously, it's important. 3,000 people are going to be there tonight. What's your take on how we how we address these events?
Well, I think in the past, the media has tended to concentrate on the gaffes, the gotcha moments, the conflict that happens. And they don't always pick up on maybe what the most important things are for the viewers. And that's one
and listeners,
exactly. Yeah. And that's, you know, I think that's one of the complaints, once again, in a lot of the research I've done with focus groups, is that we turn the TV off and they don't listen to any of it. And then we ask them, you know, if it's like the second debate, what did you think about the coverage of the first? And they do usually complain that there's not enough substance, they don't get enough of the issues. Now, I think public radio does a very good job of that.
Yes. Bless you.
But others don't. And it's often, you know, a lot of sports metaphors, which don't resonate with a lot of people. So the coverage isn't as detailed. But, you know, the advantage people have now is that you can go online, and once again, I'm going to laud public radio here. You can go on NPR's website, and the transcript of the debate has the fact-checking right in there with the sentences highlighted. So if people didn't feel like they got what they needed, there are certainly places now that we have all of this internet access. Yeah,
the accessibility of the transcripts is so helpful. If you just want to go back and check, for example, at the vice presidential and presidential debate, I had a hypothesis that was confirmed by the transcripts. Nobody mentioned the word Benghazi, which stunned me. Right. I couldn't believe that.
Yeah.
So, but I also think that sometimes the substance is overlooked. I thought that the vice presidential debate, contrary to a lot, had a whole lot of substance to it. I thought the moderator did a good job of asking a whole lot of substantive questions, and they provided some answers to that. I thought that was great.
We only got 30 seconds left. Very, very quickly, a final thought about tonight, Diana Carl?
I think it's going to be interesting. I don't think they will disappoint us. I think there will be a surprise or two. But it's hard. You know, this has been the most unpredictable, so I'm not going to predict exactly what that will be.
I agree with that. I think the days after this could be even more interesting than the debate itself, which will be pretty interesting.
Well, we only have a few hours to wait, 4 hours to wait. By the way, get all that fact-checking on stlpublicradio.org. It'll be happening live. Diana Carlin and Dave Robertson, thank you so much for being with us. Enjoy the rest of your day and enjoy your evening.
Yeah. Thanks for the opportunity. Thanks.
We'll ask you also to join NPR's Michelle Martin tonight at 7 for a special pre-debate program. She'll be joined by NPR reporters and analysts in Washington and St. Louis, and we'll check in with voters in New Hampshire, Arizona, and Pennsylvania tonight at 7 on STL Public Radio, St. Louis Public Radio. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a day-after look at tonight's debate with Washington University Vice Chancellor Steve Givens, our three St. Louis Public Radio reporters, and the presidents of the Washington University College Democrats and College Republicans. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. The special edition of St. Louis On the Air, a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.